You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network. Visit jabberjawmedia.com for more shows like this one.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to the podcast. I hope y'all had a good break. I had a tremendously good one. It was just good because I didn't have to do a bunch of podcasts over the break. As much as I love podcasting, I haven't had even one week where I didn't do multiple podcasts in years, and it's the first time I've done that, so that's really been a treat for me. Instead, I spent my time and I built a podcast table. You could probably find it on my Instagram or something, but I had a great time just working with wood and working by myself quietly. I did listen to a lot of podcasts, though, while I was doing it. But I'm glad to be back now with the show. Today's conversation is fascinating and stimulating. Or to me, I should say it is to me. It may not be to you. But to me, it was a quite fascinating conversation that I had with Steve Holliday, who is a teacher and a doctoral candidate at Texas Tech University. And he and a group of his friends, cohort, I don't think they call them friends. I don't know what his cohorts, colleagues, did a study about selfies. So there's this whole thing where people look pejoratively and talk negatively about selfies and say how it's narcissistic and it's so vain and it's so silly and stuff like that. But he kind of traced the origins of self-documenting photography and things like that and what its uses are all the way back to, you know, to the very beginning of photography itself. This phenomenon has been going on, and it seems to serve some really important cultural and personal utilization. And so they've studied it, why people do it, and categorized it. And there's just, you know, tons of insights there that I thought were fascinating to talk about human history and human tendency and the future of humanity and this whole project we got going and Google Photos and the artificial intelligence that recognizes it for you and what it means to contribute to the pictorial history of the human race. I don't know, just it's interesting stuff. So I hope you'll like this conversation as much as I did. I want to tell you that today's show is brought to you by Rockabilia. It's a place that you should get all the officially licensed posters and t-shirts and everything that you get for pop culture and music and bands. They've got a lot of really good stuff over there. If you got some walking around money after Christmas, which some of you do, go buy a poster, t-shirt, things like that over there. This is a great place to do it, rockabilia.com, and you get a discount if you use my promo code, which is, of course, not of course, it's a little bit different. PC Break It Down is the code to use on Rockabilia's site. And if you do that, you'll get a small discount. I think it's 15% off. Yeah, it is 15% off. Also, come see Emery As Cities Burn on the road. And then if you're in Nashville, you can also see Derek Minor and King's Kaleidoscope along with Emery and As Cities Burn coming up in just a few weeks here, end of January. We're going to be in Nashville, Atlanta, Orlando, Tampa, Jacksonville, and Miami. These shows are going to go really well. It's going to be very fun to play with As Cities Burn especially and be on the road with them. I think a lot of these shows will sell out, if not all of them, depending on how big the rooms are. I don't know. But I know tickets are going fast, so please get those tickets and come and see us. You can go to emerymusic.com for that. That's all I got. All right, let's get to the show.
Break it down, Dada.
Break it down, oh, break it down. Break it down, oh, break it down. Break it down, oh, break it down. Break it down, oh, break it down.
Let's make color.
Yeah. How does it work? Would you consider yourself an academic, first of all?
Yeah. I think I come from a little bit of both. So I have a background in the industry. I worked in advertising and marketing for just over 10 years before coming back to academics.
Okay.
So now I'm in academics. And so most of my research and my teaching is all in academia now.
Mm-hmm. And so you're at Texas Tech.
Yeah, Texas Tech University.
And that's in Lubbock, right?
Yep. Down, find it on a map, look it up.
No, I've been there. I play in a band. And we travel and we play at a club in Lubbock. It's a big square room, rock club. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah. I was going to say, well, a lot of the music scene actually randomly knows where Lubbock is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've got Buddy Holly and Mac Davis. And so you've got a big history of the roots of music around here. So when Paul McCartney goes on concert, he makes sure that he tours through Lubbock and things. So
that's good. I guess, you know, there's certain drives when you're going and you got, it's a long way between Dallas and, you know, Phoenix.
Exactly. So it's a good stopover.
But yeah, I do. That's good. Do you think your background in advertising, for instance, and that industry fits in with your research here on selfies and studying this kind of digital media and stuff like that? What's your main focus?
Yeah, so when I came back to academics, I'm naturally interested in the visual communication. So there's a lot when it comes to photography and our visual communication that we have with people that attracts me research-wise and academic-wise and teaching-wise and curriculum-wise. And so I spend quite a bit of time looking at those different things. And so really my research splits into two ways. I mean, as you can see behind me and most of my office, if you could see in a 360, has to do with I research the visual messages that we use in advertising to children and families.
Mm-hmm.
Separate from that, but still under the visual communication, I'm really interested in this idea of the modern ways we communicate visually and socially. Some of my research is in selfies and some of it's just in why we communicate using selfies and how we communicate using selfies. A little bit of that photography goes into the history of photojournalism. So those images, when we think of like things like World War II or we think of September 11th, more and more as we move on from generation, there are very few people in this world that actually remember and saw certain events. And so being able to show that really our constructed memory comes through those fascinating visual images that we have with each other.
Interesting.
Or a lot of the photography that has survived throughout time. If you go back to the early mid-1800s, a lot of that photography that survived are portraits and self-portraits that that photographers took to promote their work and to be able to perpetuate the memory of them through time. And so I'm fascinated by a lot by that and how we turn that self-photography into a type of communication or memorialization.
That's interesting. So there's a lot in common between Kim Kardashian and Walt Whitman.
They come
from self-promoters from the get-go, right? You're saying.
Walt Whitman was just the original Kim Kardashian.
That's right. And I say that because when you were talking about that, it's, you know, you're right about, I hadn't thought about it in that terms, but excuse me. You know, the Ken Burns Civil War documentary, are you familiar with that?
Yeah.
It's almost all still photographs, and it was in I think Walt Whitman's, that's why it popped in my head, because he's in that, he was in that time, and it was one of the first times when there were photographs, and so that's some of the earliest history that has a photography, first major world event or American event where photography was around that you could document and do, and that's almost the whole documentary is still photos kind of slowly moving, and I know a decent amount about the Civil War and studied it in school, grew up in the South a lot and everything like that. And when I think about the Civil War, you're right. I wasn't there for it. And my constructed memories and processing of it is a lot. It's a lot of visual things from the photographs in that documentary.
Yeah. When you think of like the battlefields or you think of the hospitals or you think of the city streets, a lot of it comes from that surviving photography. And if we go back to the roots of photography, yeah, you talk Revolutionary War, like it's all written history.
Right.
Everything
totally
we know
different.
About it's a written history or something that's been reconstructed on the miniseries John Adams or something like that. Something that we can put together. But then when the Crimean War came about, that was the first time we actually started documenting war visually and taking those photographs. And that's kind of gone through. Although a lot of those photographs from the Civil War you see or from the Crimean War, they're these still life images that people have. Took a long time to develop, a long time to set up a shot. You get into World War II, and now we've advanced to a place where we can take action photos where Robert Capa and some of his contemporaries can actually get pictures of us invading Italy or invading Normandy and those really visceral images that come through World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And then as we just go along through Vietnam, and even, I mean, that just perpetuates into we just want to document as something that's happening real. We want to document something that's happening in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of leads to the selfies. I mean, we've been taking selfies, honestly, if you want to go back, we've been doing selfies since Renaissance art was doing it. There were Renaissance artists that were painting selfies.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get into photography and selfies, and you've got these you've got these original, they were the daguerreotype photographers that wanted to, hey, let me take a picture of myself so that I can promote, that I can take a portrait of you. Then you go through even kind of clunky with these selfies, but we have documented pictures of Paul McCartney taking pictures of himself in a mirror, and you can see the camera. But we've modernized it and modified this genre enough that we can actually take the pictures. We can review them instantly. We can retake them if we need to reshape or reform our image, and then we can use those to communicate in a certain way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. And you mentioned Vietnam there. That was a real interesting. I mean, there's some of the most powerful images in photography. That we'd gotten pretty good at photography by that point and had a lot of it and a lot of access. And then that makes me think now, and this is not quite related, I'm just on that train of thought, but we don't do as much of that anymore. The drive for photography has always been to get stuff and real stuff and deliver information. It's less about maybe vanity in that way. But we don't do as much war photography and stuff like that anymore. I don't think they allow the access. The governments don't allow us to do that as much anymore.
Well, and we all want it at the moment it's happening. So yeah, mm-hmm. Vietnam, we started actually having film that mm-hmm. there was film footage in World War II, but Vietnam, a lot more visual moving. Now we can actually go to, like, we can go to Instagram pages of like David Gutenfelder, the AP photographer. We can go to his Instagram page, and instantaneously we can watch videos that he's taking and uploading, whether he's in North Korea mm-hmm. or the Midwest of the United States, as he's doing it and as he's seeing it. We can see there's people taking selfies in the middle of Hurricane Harvey when it was doing. I mean, they were risking their life, whether they were news reporters or whether they were just people that had to get out to show that, hey, I'm in the middle.
That's a good point.
Look at what's happening. But we've got to see it right when it's happening. So beyond, whether it's war or whether it's natural disasters or whether it's a wedding, like I want to see it now. I want to see it when it's happening. If you're uploading a picture a week later, doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah, that's interesting. I want to ask a couple of questions right in that last thing you said, but even before that, how did you get this focus? I always find it interesting with academic people that do research, because I'm not exactly this way. I get into certain things and stay with them for a while, but not long term. How do you even become sure you're so interested in a thing you'd want to do research in the real way, the scientific way, not just the read up about it and then given an opinion about it? What makes you so sure that you want to dedicate, do a study, get the funding, see it through, write the paper, do all that work? That's always escapes me.
Yeah, no, I think it takes a certain kind of person. And I didn't start as that kind of person. When I worked in the industry, sure, I do research on consumers and consumer trends and consumer insights and things like that. It was things that was pushed by business need and business agenda that we had. And so it was a little bit different of a process, but coming back to academics and sitting down and be like, what are my passions? What am I really interested in? Sure, I'm interested in advertising. That's why I worked in that industry for so long. But what is it that really gets to me? And that's where I really started looking at some of these questions. I mean, it all starts with a research question. What is it that really fascinates you, that you want to understand the psychology behind it? You mm-hmm. want to understand the behaviors behind it. How we can see violence on television and watch repeated violence on television, and then all of a sudden it grows a fear in us that we might be the next victim of that violent act, even though that act might be happening halfway around the world. Mm-hmm. Like, what is it in us that breeds that kind of connection with the media and gets us fascinated and actually internally, psychologically, behaviorally affects the way we are as human beings? And so if you can grab onto a question, I think, that fascinates you that way, then it's just a matter of going out and talking to people, surveying people, finding out how they actually consume media, how they actually, in this case, how they actually take selfies. In the study that we did at the beginning, that was published at the end of last year, this one was, what is it? We see people taking selfies all the time, and there's so much in the media that says that it's an act of vanity mm-hmm. or it's an act of narcissism. But I mean, I have parents who are in their 60s, 70s, grandparents who are in their 80s, 90s that are taking selfies. Is that is that vanity? Is that narcissism? So when I started reading stuff in popular culture and in popular media, and then started seeing, well, people I know don't do it for that reason. And then if that's where it fascinates me, and I've got to go and talk to people and figure out, well, what different kinds of people there are that are there that engage in these behaviors, and have the ideas that this is the kind of image I want to take and how I want to communicate.
That's, yeah, there's just a whole lot there. Very, very rich answer there. What is your field of expertise and degrees in what?
So right now I'm a doctoral candidate. Mm-hmm. I teach mass communication. Specifically, I teach advertising courses, and I'm a PhD candidate. So I'm working on my doctoral degree. I have a master's degree in mass communication with a focus in advertising. And I'm finishing up my dissertation right now. And then this next school year, so next August, I'll go and I'll become a professor or a faculty member at a university.
So how deeply back do you go in? I mean, because you're getting into, you know, in the last answer you gave, a bunch of stuff comes up there for me, and it's in the fields of psychology and evolutionary biology, I think, there. Do you have to, you know, get caught up and do a lot of reading in those areas to tackle this problem here? I mean, just to do this one study.
Yeah, you kind of do. And that's kind of the bucket that we fall into in mass communication. So if you're looking at journalism, or you're looking at public relations, or you're looking at electronic media or advertising, a lot of the questions we have to do with the behaviors or the thoughts that people have that lead to the way they consume these, or the way that media affects them. So to do that in mass communication, we're influenced by a lot of, there's business and consumer behavior. There's a lot of psychology. There's a lot of sociology. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these theories that go into researching how we consume media. And so, yeah, when you're doing a research project, you have to spend a little bit of time in that psychology literature and in that sociology literature and whatever it may be, to understand what kind of theories guide our behaviors and our thoughts.
I mean, if you just think about it, like what you said there about people being willing to document, first of all, war is obviously dangerous. And, you know, hurricanes, tornado chasers. I mean, people will risk, I mean, that's profound, really. People will take whatever technology is available and risk their lives to capture a flat visual image of something and just share it. Like, way, you know, I imagine people did that as early as they possibly could. There's something in a human that strives for, I'm trying to even get at the base of what that even would be, that it would be worth that kind of risk and that obsessive thinking or use of resources to what's the drive there coming out of people to do that? But it's clearly a very, very common motivation.
Yeah. And that's in academics and in any kind of research that we do, behavioral research or cognitive or thoughts, research on thoughts, is that idea of what are those different things? What are the different motivators? What are the different developmental things that go into your decision to do to participate in that kind of activity? Fortunately, as media continues to change in advance, that's going to change in advance. As we're introduced to new kinds of media, as our world grows and we engage with people of different cultures, people of different ethnicities, different geographically, so different from us, like that's going to have to shift and that's going to have to change. And so that's why we do this research when it comes mm-hmm. to social. The social sciences is all about those social interactions and how do those social interactions impact the way we exist as individuals and as collective societies.
Because it's kind of like, it feels to me like it's working on the whole human project. Like this, it gets crazy, because it feels to me like there's certain individuals in the, I don't know, in the population who are predisposed to care about this stuff and do it and do, like I said, the risky things or just the obsessive parts of it. And it must be, it seems like it's programmed in there for a purpose or a benefit or information sharing that makes the species stronger, so, you know, all in that kind of territory. And then as it gets going forward, I mean, you can just see, like, if you take a super zoomed out point of view, first of all, there's no different than people doing it back then and today, except for, I mean, there's specific things that make it different just incidentally, but it seems like the same drive is there for some of that. And you can see real quickly, if you zoom way ahead, think of all the contributions of all the people, humans, making decisions on what to document and why, that's going to feed what is big data, algorithmic learning, artificial intelligence, things like we are choosing the data set of what is important for to do something transcendent, even beyond what we're doing at the moment. Every time you take a selfie just in the bathroom about your makeup, that is contributing to the human superorganism and what humans value and where we're headed and what it means, you know, don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, and if you look at, like, if you think back 50 years, like, we've got some images that are really iconic images, but you don't have many images of your family sitting around a Christmas table or sitting around a menorah or whatever we happen to be doing in our culture and in our tradition. We have birthdays, but we don't have the mundane. Now when we get into selfie culture, when we get into things like Snapchat and Instagram, or just whatever kind of photography, we have images of everything.
Everything.
Once upon a time, I used to put together wedding videos for friends and really, really close family and things. And I'd ask them, hey, send me the pictures of you growing up. And it was really easy because they'd send me a couple pictures of them as an 8-year-old, 9-year-old, 12-year-old, 15-year-old, 18-year-old. Maybe they'd have 150 pictures or something that I'd have to pare down that were really memorable moments in their lives. I have a 9-year-old daughter. Like, I've documented like thousands and thousands of pictures. Her wading through that will just be this continual loop of images of herself. And what that means for our future society is that we're gaining knowledge.
Yes, right.
50 years from now, we won't be able to say, you know, I don't remember what it was like. I don't remember what my grandma looked like when she was putting on makeup in the bathroom. Probably have a picture of it somewhere that we can go and pull up and we can look at. Does that matter? I mean, that's the question that's left to us as society and as research. As 50 years from now, is that just is that throwaway knowledge, or does that actually contribute to who we are and make us a richer culture and a richer people and provide us more understanding of people that are different than us or our own ancestors even?
I think it has to. It has to be significant and matter. I mean, even if you just think about the fact that these images are not local, almost all the ones we're talking about, everything, as soon as you take it, it goes to the cloud or it's on this. Like, I'm not worried about my phone getting destroyed. It's on Instagram. I have a hashtag. I don't have one, but I should have a hashtag for subcategories of things about my daughter or my job or whatever it is. And then that's, I don't know to say that that's permanent, but it's likely permanent and it's likely out of my hands and it's likely a contribution to some data set that will contribute to the design of our future society. Every time you take a selfishly motivated selfie, whatever that is, and I guess that's kind of what your research gets at, is debunking the notion that selfies themselves are inherently narcissistic or bad or something wrong with that.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, everybody in society engages in this. I mean, I shouldn't make a blanket statement like that, but the good majority of society engages in that, and it's kids as young as 4 years old that take their parents' phone and like to do the filters on Snapchat.
Oh gosh, they go crazy with that stuff where it'll put bunny ears on your song. I can't believe how strong of a thing that is for children. It's amazing.
Even children.
It freaks me out.
And then you've got your grandparents. Your grandparents will take that picture and send it to you, or take a selfie of themselves opening a present across the country that they want to thank you for giving to them this time of year, right? Everybody engages in this. And so it's just not feasible anymore to think that people do this for a purely narcissistic quality.
What is the what do we have for a working definition of selfie then?
So a selfie is, I should look this up for you. I actually have the study, because we had to go and figure out exactly how we construct this definition. So let me find the actual definition we used.
Okay. Because, I mean, you know, if you go all the way back, you say self-portrait.
Yep.
You know, you could paint a self-portrait. Maybe that in some sense counts as a precursor to a selfie.
Okay. So the word selfie entered the English language actually through a 2002 Australian online forum. Oxford Dictionaries took that over the next 10 years. But in 2013, Oxford Dictionaries had formally defined the word selfies to be a photograph that one has taken of oneself, typically one taken with a smartphone or webcam and uploaded to a social media website. Ah. So there's a few things involved in there. Yep. It's no longer like, if you look at it, the Paul McCartney iconic picture of him taking a picture in a mirror is no longer a selfie by today's definition. Mm-hmm. Academics have further refined that, and they define it as a self-portrait made with a smartphone's camera and immediately distributed and inscribed into a network. A selfie is an instant visual communication of where we are, what we're doing, who we think we are, and who we think is watching.
See, the problem I have with that definition is there's the classic idea of, you know, when somebody says selfie with a pejorative context, they mean like a lady in a bathroom making puffy lips and she takes 90 in a row to get the perfect one. Now, I would argue that all of those 90, regardless of whether or not they were shared or not, were certainly selfies though.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
This definition says they had to be uploaded and shared, and not only that, immediately to count as a selfie.
Yeah. And that's the definition. I mean, we have self photographs, mm-hmm, and we have selfies. And even in the selfie world though, there are a number of people who have private Instagram accounts. Mm-hmm. If I upload it and it's just for myself, or I upload it somewhere on the cloud, arguably shareable, but it's a private account that I don't have anyone on, and I collect them so I can create portraits or I can give to clients or whatever it might be. Is that a selfie? If I'm just doing it for myself and no one's seeing it, even though it may be shareable by that definition that says immediately distributed, described into a network. So by today's definition, it's becoming more and more you're taking and you're sharing a selfie. And that's really what our study looked at, is why do you take and share selfies? But there are, even within that, there are some people who take and share selfies as that pure memorialization, which is the reason we've done self photographs for a long time. Mm-hmm. But then we also have some people who, back when we did self photographs, that took it to build their brand image, which is still what a lot of those people are doing today when they distribute their selfie immediately.
So typically, there was a time before this, at least, or it is generally pejorative to talk about selfies, and there's people that say there's a selfie disease. Like, what's the setup for this? What are the thoughts on people that have been saying selfies are a problem, and where does that come from?
Yeah. Well, I think it comes from the same place in the media. I mean, I honestly haven't done my research in this specific niche, but in my observation and my reading of popular culture and research, there are people that do things. There are people that fall off cliffs while taking selfies. I mean, I don't make light of that, but there are people who have tragic situations happen while engaging in these behaviors. There are people who go out in the middle of hurricanes and unfortunate things happen to them because they want to get that selfie so they can share it with their network, right? And so we see these things happen, and we try to make these conclusions about those moments as blanket statements for what communication through self-photography or through a selfie is. I mean, this could be a bigger conversation, not to go down a rabbit hole, but I mean, this is when we deal with public policy a lot and things too. A lot of times we look at the lowest common denominator in our society, whether that's this a lot of times is good things. I mean, when I was growing up, we didn't have seatbelts in our car. Mm-hmm. I don't even know if I had to ride in a car seat what standards that car seat may have met back in the early 1980s when I was riding around in a car. But because of certain events or certain situations that happened, those guided public policy. And so when we get into selfies, we see these exemplars of what a selfie is, and we take those and we run with those. But selfies can be boiled down to people are going to take millions and millions of selfies this holiday just to communicate back and forth with each other.
Yeah.
Snapchat was built around the idea that I may not want to build my brand, or I may not want to memorialize anything because it's not going to last, but I want to add something visual to however I'm communicating with you or with a small group of people. Mm-hmm.
Well, so tell me about this research specifically. How did you do it?
So in this research, this was exploratory research where we wanted to start out and just find out what motivates individuals to actually engage in this. And specifically, we were interested in taking and sharing selfies. So we weren't just the people who take them and put them in a photo album, or take them and put them on their artistic wall or something like that. But these are the people that are actually sharing in a network so that we could follow the identified definition that we've kind of operated under. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to see what motivates people to engage in that, especially since everyone seemed to say, like we were talking about before, that it's narcissistic. And so we went out to across the media, and we looked at, we went through discussion boards, through forums, through academic articles and academic research, through popular culture, and seeing why did people say they did it? Why did people say they were doing this and engaging in this? And from that, we took all the statements we could find and put them all together in what became a survey that we had people then take the survey and sort through each of these items and say, yeah, that one is like me, or that one's not like me. And the way we did the research actually forced them to internally and personally negotiate each one of these statements and figure out, you know, this one's more important than this one to me, or this reason is less important to me, and go through those. I mean, some of these things, if I look back in here just to see the list of statements again, some of these statements, to tell my story, because I have control of how I look, because it captures exactly how I'm feeling, to make me feel good looking, to document myself for myself so I can record memories, to show people where I am, fun new ways to communicate. So all of these were different reasons that they had to negotiate personally. And we, as they negotiated those, we saw the data come in, and we saw these trends, or we saw the data come in. And then we said, well, what trends are there? Is everybody responding the same way, and will it confirm that people really are just narcissistic?
Yeah. Was there a question on there? It's like an option is just, well, just to show off because I'm badass. Yeah. I mean, how do you phrase that one?
There were a number of those ones. Let me see if I can grab
you
some.
You take
of those.
A selfie too, if you look this good, you know, that answer.
when I think I look nice, mm-hmm. Just to update my profile picture, to discover new sides of myself.
How about to try to get dates, to attract a mate?
Yeah.
That would be a one.
I'd have to look through all the whole list we did, but a lot to impress people.
Mm-hmm, right.
Because I'm impressed with the way I look, to show off my looks.
Yeah, there you go.
So all these are the different statements that are in there, and finding these different statements. And then we took everyone's responses and we did what we call a factor analysis. So we started pulling apart and saying, does everyone respond the same way? We quickly realized that no, not everyone responds the same way. When we came up with it, what actually surfaced was that there were three distinct groups of people.
How many people did you survey?
So in this one, and this initial one was just exploratory. So what we did, it was about 50 individuals that we pulled together to identify how they responded. So, and we do this a lot in research to kind of get an idea for what's out there. Mm-hmm. And then we take that information and we can do it with groups of hundreds, or we can do it with groups of thousands. But this initial research was just, and we're working on follow-up research with it, but just finding out what does exist, what trends exist. And so in this, with these individuals, we quickly realized that there were three different groups of people that surfaced. And the cool thing is that even though we didn't do it with hundreds or thousands of people, over the last year since it was published, I've had so many people come to me like, oh yeah, that's totally the kind of person I am. Whether that's self-fulfilling or not is up, I guess, up in the air. But having those things validated, where people keep coming and saying, yeah, that totally fits. That's it. And it's not necessarily something that's always flattering when they come. They're like, yeah, it's totally because I like the way I look, or I totally make sure I have the right image of myself before I share it with anybody. Mm-hmm. Cause I want it to be just perfect. Or some people are, you know what? Yeah, I don't do it to even communicate. I just do it to memorialize myself. And so seeing that come about, but we saw these three different trends of people come about. And in the analysis, as we did it, they pulled apart really, really distinctly, where we had this one group of people that just did it. I mean, not just, but their primary motivation was to communicate with people.
So let me see if I understand the way that works in the research. You would have all the questions and they would all have a certain tag of factor analysis that would put them in a category that the person taking the survey wouldn't know. But there's a hidden tag, like these all point, like how do you decide do you not have to predefine the categories? That's maybe a technical question, but how do you know what emerges from just all the random?
Yeah, that's the part we don't know. So there's all these statements and they're throwing them together. And I mean, I can look at all the statements and I kind of see that, like, oh, this one is definitely more something or other. But when it pulls together these three factors, it doesn't say, hey, these people all like to communicate. It pulls together and says, hey, these people have these five or six that significantly represent them.
Okay, so they're more unique. Like the people that were answering this way all seem to answer this way and not at all this way. There's something in the math there that sorts that and helps you, you know, see that they have multiple things that line up that are distinct from one another in motivation.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There's this group of statements that these people were all really strongly felt really strongly about. There's this other group of statements that this group of people felt really negatively about.
And so they're answering these questions that, like it says, it'll have a statement and then they'll say strongly agree, not neutral, like that kind of survey.
Yeah, basically like that. Yeah. What the method we actually did funnels them into like a pyramid, where you only have like one item that really represents you. And that one is like the most strongly agree of all the 46 statements that we had. And then you could have more that were in the middle that were, yeah, kind of like me. And then you had just a few to eventually just one that was absolutely not like me. Mm-hmm. And so it does. It pulls those apart just like that same kind of strongly disagree to strongly mm-hmm. agree. We can just do with all 46 of the statements that we found across media.
Okay. Well, so let's go on with what are the three main things you found there?
Yeah, so in these three main things, we found that there were individual. Oh, so real quick though, before with the data, what we ended up finding out was as these emerged, we saw these three trends, but we didn't know what they were. So that's where we had to go back and we had to take all the statements and lay them out and we had to say, so what is it saying about these people? And this is where it becomes kind of qualitative. Us as researchers looked at those statements and says, how are we going to judge these people mm-hmm. based on what all of these statements that showed significance? How are we going to, what are we going to say about these people that is honest about them? And so the first group of people, as we looked at it, we noticed that most of the statements that these people were talking about had to do with communication. It didn't have to do with, it could be disposable communication. It could be communication that lasts on Instagram, but it's something that I wanted to send to you. Or something that I wanted to, maybe in their minds, that if they were sending, their social network was a group text message or something. So it's something that was just for communication back and forth, primarily for communication back and forth. Mm-hmm. The second group of people are the autobiographers, is what we termed them. And these are the people that the communication is important, but it's not an immediate gratification. It's not an immediate communication. It's a memorialization. So some of what they're doing may be for, they want to document it so someone can see it later, so someone can come across it later, so that they have it for themselves.
Archival, almost.
Yeah, archival purposes. And we noticed that everybody had a little bit of this archival purpose. It's just that this was the group that was really the strongest in. Archival for other people to see, but not now, and not to build my brand and build mm-hmm. my name.
That's like the classic person that when they first got a camera or goes on a vacation or something, they're just constantly doing, you know, the guy that first has a Sony Handycam, you know, and just has it on all the time. You're like, what are you doing with this? I'm just capturing, I'm getting the memories, man, but it's not, you're never going to watch it. 1,000 hours on VHS somewhere.
Yeah. Well, and going back to what we were talking about 50 years from now, somebody may sit down and watch that entire thing.
Yes.
So that they can see as a document of that person's life, and it becomes a biography or an autobiography of that person's life. Mm-hmm. And that's why they did it.
Oh, it could be. Yeah, you're right. Because like I have a friend that was like that when I play in a band and we travel all the time. And I had a friend in the early days of that had a camera. He was just on it all the time. And we didn't have this technology to share it or do anything. It was like, Jordan, knock it off. You're never going to watch any of this footage. But now, 10 years later, he has all this amazing footage of stuff that was unimportant, completely unimportant at the time. And now it's just such a wonderful window that, you know, it's kind of like a gamble. Like, yeah, this might be boring, but I'm going to see now. It's like, maybe it'll be worth something in the future. It's like an investment or something.
Yeah. And the thing with selfies though, is, I mean, people have done this, but now I have to be in it too, right? It's chronicling me and what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. It's not me taking a picture of the Eiffel Tower. It's in front of the Eiffel Tower. It's not me taking a video of a hurricane. It's me taking a video of myself in the hurricane, right?
Yeah, that's like we used to get film. You'd send it off or whatever, and you get this big stack of stuff. Or if you're a kid and go through your parents' photo album or whatever, you just, I mean, we've always kind of known this as crystallized more now, but you flip. I'm in that one. Stop. Look at it. It's just a, you know, there has to be something reflexive or narcissistic there, but not in a disordered way, but something where you're drawn to yourself or even your aunt. Like if your aunt takes a picture of the Eiffel Tower, it's not a good photograph. It's not, she's not a skilled photographer, but if she and Aunt Bob are in it, well, that's kind of interesting. Then now it's interesting now. It has a context that I can care about. I don't need to see their composition of the Eiffel Tower from wherever it was they were standing. That's useless. But now yeah, selfies kind of fix that.
The compositional elements right. that go into photography. So it's, yeah. Yeah. So then the third group is the one that becomes interesting. And that's the group, I mean, they're all interesting, but this is the one that is kind of confirms what we think of a society, but it doesn't have to be in a negative way. But these are what we term the self-publicists. So these are people who are doing it to build some kind of a self-image or to build some kind of a brand. They want to communicate it. It's actually for your benefit. It's not so much for it's going to build them in a roundabout way, but it's for your benefit, for you to see it and for you to validate them as individuals. And so it does come back to them and helps them to tailor and to build who they are. But these are the individuals who, like we were talking about, will take 10, 20 pictures before finding the right one that says, hey, this is a good representation of who I am. And it's because it's part of a bigger idea of this is more about my brand than just communicate with you. It's about me and it's about a bigger piece of me than just the ongoing mundane parts of my life.
And how is that, you know, how is that different than going all the way back from Kylie Jenner to Walt Whitman or whatever we were saying is it really the same thing? This reality star thing now feels like it's on another level, like of self-promotion that definitely turns people off a little bit though. Like what's the difference there? Or is there no difference?
I mean, you go back. Well, and that's the way, like, I hate to judge these ones because these ones aren't necessarily negative. Mm-hmm. If we go back before the actual selfies and we go back to self-photography, and I've mentioned this a couple times now, but we go back to the initial daguerreotype photographers back at the end of the Civil War, the end of the 1800s, beginning of 1900s. These people, a lot of these professional photographers would take selfies so that they could turn around and show people, hey, I do have good compositional skills. I have the ability to make you look good. Mm-hmm. And so that was building their image and their brand as a photographer. And so there are certain people that this still comes across. Sometimes I'll take a selfie and I don't like the way I look in this one, or it's not necessarily because I'm full of myself, but it's because I want to show who I am. I want to position myself as whether that's a confident person or whether it's a knowledgeable person or a fun loving person in certain situations. I just want it to be representative of who I am as a brand. These are the people when we talk to them and talk to them about, hey, why did you put these things? These are people that said, I don't really like other people to take pictures of me because I don't have.
Yeah, you're right. That's true.
I look, right? I don't have control over the way I look. I don't have control over my double chin or making sure my best side is out or making sure I sucked in my stomach or I tucked in my shirt right. And you took that and you put it on social media, and that's not me. That's not my image. That's not my brand.
See, that all confuses me a little bit because there's a lot to think about in there. I mean, everybody's aware of the brand stuff. I know we've always kind of that's always existed, but I don't remember people in the 90s, the amount of people aware of the projection of their personal brand is not like it is today, though. Like now your personal brand, it's just, gosh, it makes me want to gag. Everybody talking about their brand all the time. But now that it's out there in the zeitgeist and stuff, it's kind of impossible. It's like we've been told so much that we have a brand that now it's like, well, shit, I guess I have to deal with the fact that I have a brand because I'm just a human with an Instagram account, much less a podcaster or public, what did you call it? You know, just a public figure or something. But it now everybody, that's what makes people freak out a little bit. It's like, oh, is everybody a public figure now, kind of a thing, you know? And was it like that? Were the people that aware of it back a long time ago? Or is that, maybe it's a good thing, I guess, just to be aware of it. Because like you said, we're always trying to position ourselves when we're at a party. I mean, whether or not somebody's got a camera or not, I guess. So we're just kind of all aware of it now.
And I guess the images just weren't omnipresent mm-hmm. back then, right? I mean, like if I wanted to present my brand, it was me and you hanging out socially. It wasn't something that was captured for time and all eternity, or as long as we have pictures, right? It wasn't something, if I wanted that kind of preservation, it was something you took a picture of me, but that wasn't self-presentation. And the self-presentation mm-hmm. I did visually, it was probably in a photo album that I showed you, or was hanging on a wall when you came to my house or something, of my family yeah. picture. That's the picture I want of my family, right?
Yeah.
So now, I mean, it's an ever-present part of our life that we are constantly seeing who we are, and we're constantly aware of who we are. Some of us don't mind. Like, I don't mind if somebody takes a picture of me and I happen to be in the background of someone's picture. They're not always flattering, but I'm cool with that. Yeah. But at the same time, the ones I take of myself, yeah, there might be some self-branding in that, making sure that the ones I have control over are. But I think there's different levels of how comfortable we are with our own brand and how comfortable we are with our brand when it's not us taking that image.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I mean, there's so many people that, especially in the past, if you pull out a camera, they say, don't take my picture, you know, somebody in your family or one of your friends, don't take my picture. And, you know, they're worried about how they, you know, come across, like you said, double chin or weird hair day or whatever it's going to be. And now it's like, with the technology that we have, it's kind of exciting, but it's also like a runaway situation where everybody's aware of their branding and projection and they have the technology to do it and get it right. So you have these people that would have avoided cameras like crazy, and now they can spend 10 minutes with the portrait effect in their iPhone X and get it right. And now they feel like they can participate, but it's also perpetuating this whole art form, like this parabolic increase in selfie technique. Just the interest in photography is just stunning. The amount of people that spend thousands of dollars on cameras now and are good at it. It's just like a runaway phenomenon, it seems like.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's this opportunity for us to be engaged in the narrative, and mm-hmm. that narrative includes us. I mean, I think some of those people are probably aware, but the one that always blows my mind is the algorithms on Facebook. Whenever I go into my phone or on Facebook, it'll say, hey, is this a picture of you? Do you want to tag you in it?
Mm-hmm.
How many people are we not connected with in social media where we're in the background of someone's beach photo, or we're in the background of someone's restaurant photo? And just because we're not connected with them, that algorithm's not going to ask, hey, is this Steve Holiday or is this Matt Carter, right? If we could have access to that and see all the pictures that we're really in this world, I think it would blow our minds.
Oh, yeah, it's terrifying. It is. I mean, the AI on those things is so good on Google Photos. It can recognize... Oh gosh, it's just intimidating to even think about where it is now compared to a few years ago. They say it couldn't recognize a cat or a dog, and now it just knows my daughter, everybody, all the time, organized for me. Like, do you want to see pictures of this person that I used to know? There's a bunch of them in my photo roll that I didn't even know I had pictures of them, and I've got seven, it turns out, of some person that I don't even care about, but I know. And Google says, yeah, this person, they're part of your life, right? And I go, yeah, I guess they are. You know, it's just insane.
I don't want to lock my pictures. It's kind of creepy.
Yeah, the whole thing must tie into the need for, you know, legacy or something deep. Like, who am I? Who was I? Like, deep stuff. Just in this fingertip of the selfie and get your lips to poke out. But it's really about your whole legacy and who you are and your contribution to the future of humanity. You could get really big thinking about all that. That's funny.
I mean, if we had selfies for, like, Abraham Lincoln or Martin Luther King to take pictures of themselves, would we know a different person?
Oh, 100%.
Who we remember.
100%.
If Martin Luther King Jr. was taking selfies and sharing it, and that was the documented representation we had, or JFK or even Abraham Lincoln, like, who is that person? Like,
oh, you'd know so much. If you had tens of thousands of selfies or pictures from other people that they were in, you'd know what kind of food Abraham Lincoln like? Maybe you'd have a bunch of stuff about his behaviors. You'd probably catch weird stuff, personality quirks, or be able to diagnose diseases he may have had. There'd be so much information you could go back
well,
about.
You could see the angle of him that he wanted people to see, maybe. Maybe his own personal brand. Like, that's not a personal brand that we see of any of those people, right? It's the brand that journalists took. It's the brand that photographers took. Like, I mean, so much of today is about us documenting, us showing the right side of ourselves.
Because we decide now, like, you'd have to be, like, Obama has that photographer guy, followed him around and got all this stuff. But even that was, like, that was a calculated way to present that kind of a thing versus
angle of
general.
Him, right?
Yeah, and just for misinformation alone, I will have contributed more pictures of me than all the other people combined, probably. So I will be the ones that I chose will be dominant in history. If you come back 1,000 years, you'll see the pictures everybody took of me, but I'll probably be more of me taken of myself than anybody else, so I can kind of flood the market there.
Right, yeah, right. That's and weird. The picture of you will see is the one you wanted. Mm-hmm. You wanted then.
Yeah.
Another thing before I don't know how much time we have, but before we run away, one thing when it comes to selfies, though, and this is kind of where my research is going, is that even if we don't take selfies, we are incredibly attracted to selfies.
Mm-hmm.
There's something about that outstretched arm, about being in close proximity to the camera like you and I are right now, and me reaching out and that arm bringing you into me to see me. And especially if I'm looking out at that camera and I'm connecting with you through my eyes. There's something there that brings us in and holds our attention captive, that makes us intensely personally connected with you, even though you're on the other side of a camera, even though you're not physically in. And so there's a lot of research being developed out there that looks at like the attention that grabs and the emotional connection that relates us to each other. And so there's something to the more and more we become a selfie-saturated society, perhaps the more and more socially connected and personally connected we feel to the people on the other side of those images.
Well, see, that's a thing I'm kind of interested in there, because we got a weird thing going on right now with the technology, and there's real deep stuff to learn about humans, which is what you're doing, which is exciting. There's stuff, latent qualities about humans that are both good and bad that we do not understand yet. And kind of the research you're doing is getting, like, why does that matter? Why does the arm in the picture draw you in? What about where you're looking? And, you know, what we're going to have to design webcams and all this stuff for the future. So we need to tap into what we're built for and why we are the way that we are. But it's important because we've spent all these, I guess, tens of thousands and millions of years developing communication, including body language, visual stuff, eye contact. These things are just the most important developments in humans. It's part of what enables us to dominate the globe is some of this communication stuff and information and knowledge sharing and why and what works and who you assess and assessing threats, all this stuff. And we have more technology than ever. And there's a giant gulf there because now most communication, actual communication that happens, is freaking text-based stuff. And it drives me crazy. I'm a talker. I use inflection and tone. That's just still in the audio part. And then body language is huge if I'm talking to somebody. I cannot tell you how many times I'm on some email chain with going back and forth with something about business. We go back and we're on the fifth email a week and a half into the thing. And I say, can the person just call me on the damn phone. I'll know in 5 minutes everything I need to know about the venue we're trying to book and what it looks like and if we can do what I am intending to do. Will the person just call me? This will take 5 minutes, not six emails over 2 weeks. And everything you do is you live your whole life in text messages. And so, you know, on the other side of it, there's, of course, this visual stuff that's happening too, but they're not connected really right now. It's either you share a still photograph, which we're getting, it's good, it's progress in a way, but it's also backwards. Both the visual and language, we've sacrificed the integrated experience of communication, and it's a huge problem, I think.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, and there's certain kinds of communication we've made it much more stilt and difficult. Like I mean, even in personal communications, I don't know how many text messages I've been in with my family or with friends that's not business related where I misinterpret what they're saying.
Totally.
The exciting thing of adding the visual of a selfie, like through something like Snapchat or through my just my text messaging, is that I can then put an expression with it that's not just an emoji that someone else has prepared for me.
So weird.
I can give you something, or I can even FaceTime with you now. FaceTime is really selfie and video, right? I mean, we're still holding it at arm's length. We're still talking with each other. We're still in that intimate perspective, intimate distance from each other. But now you and I, we can see each other's expressions. Yeah. It's not us emailing back and forth to each other, having to ask for clarifications about certain things or try to interpret each other's tone about it.
You can just know so much about a person in, gosh, 10 seconds if you can see them and hear them. And 10 seconds is all it takes for me to know almost everything I need to know. And then there's a few details after that. That's what most communication is like. And I like podcasting for that reason, because you get to actually hear where the person is coming from.
Right.
I mean, I like you much better now than the guy that wrote the abstract of that research paper. You're a real person now. I mean,
I've gone back to that article a number of times. I read that. I'm like, man, I tried to break it down on a
not just that it was bad.
Some of it's written for just academics, right? Yeah. And so it's, but it seems like we felt that urge to go back, and we want to, as much as some people want to talk negatively about selfies, like it's given us the opportunity to get back to that.
Mm-hmm.
Like when we wrote long form notes to each other, or if you remember back to the late 1990s, we wrote these long form emails to each other. And then we started getting text messaging, and we're still just textually communicating with each other. We're not visually communicating with each other because there's some geographic distance separating us, whether that's across town, a couple offices over, or whatever it is. There's something separating us that we feel we have to communicate that way. And so bringing the selfie into it allowed us initially to have that still photo that extended that communication, that allowed us to add something visual to the textual to make it more dynamic. And now we've started to go to things like Snapchat and FaceTime and Skype and things like that, that allow us over these last 10 years, that allow us to really add more of the vocals to it, some more of the tone that we can make it even more dynamic. But it's all because we were fed up with misinterpreting each other's tone. And well, dang it, you know what? I'm going to add something visual to that.
Yeah. Well, it's like we're reintegrating all of the stuff slowly, but we started by fracturing. And, you know, people don't want to talk on everybody tells me, I don't want to talk on the phone, I just text. I mean, there's a trade-off there, at least. I don't think it's a good one when you get into stuff like Twitter and nuance and detail and arguments and sharing of complicated ideas. This is not good. This is a bad use of the trade-off at that point. It's easier to be on your couch and say, yeah, bring me Chinese food. Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
But for more complicated stuff, it's not going to work. So we've got to figure out how to create it and incentivize people to utilize the full spectrum of communication if we're going to move forward as a species, the way I see it.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm the kind of person, I don't love talking on a telephone.
Mm-hmm.
But I am not the kind of person that says, well, but I don't want you to come to my house and visit with me in person either. I like the visual communication.
Yeah.
And I like adding that to that. And we are getting back to that. We have to get back to that, I think.
Well, just looking
also,
at it.
But also when it comes to like consumer behaviors, like when you were talking big data earlier, advertisers and marketers, going back to that's where I bridge the selfies with my advertising, is that there are advertisers are aware of this.
Yeah.
And I sent this over to you before the show, but there are tons of advertisements. We see them, whether it's commercials or print ads, where advertisers are aware how intimately personal and how attention grabbing selfies are. And so we've started to incorporate that into those selfies. And that's where the next step of research and my research is kind of going is how does that really impact us? How does that impact our consumer behaviors, our consumer thoughts, our consumer considerations by capitalizing on that form of communication?
So what's the end goal of your research? Is it just to do it in and of itself, or is it to help an advertising community? Like what is your long-term motivation keeps you going on this kind of thing?
Yep. That,
learn
that's
a bunch
a
and then go
question.
Make a bunch of money in advertising again once you master it.
Yeah, exactly. No, my end goal, like I like researching. I'm solidly in academics. I see my future helping out in the industry professionally and bringing my knowledge back, and then bringing my academic research knowledge back to the industry. But that's the thing, like with academic research, we've got to be able to get it in the hands of those that it matters to, whether that's me, whether that's us communicating with the advertising industry, saying, yes, this is working, capitalize on this and keep doing this. No matter how we feel as consumers about that, or whether that's communicating through consumer methods, like being able to write on a blog or to visit with parents or to speak to parents or the everyday consumer about, hey, this is what's actually happening. Are you aware that this is how you're responding to it? So we can become more literate. I think the end game is to get us to be more literate in the end, where it's like, hey, I know what's happening. And now I'm an informed consumer that is like, do I want that to affect me? Do I want to have that product, or do I want that advertisement to affect me in that way? Am mm-hmm. I okay with that? Then cool, I'm okay with that. If I'm not, then let me stop. Let me have the capacity and capability to stop and say, yeah, okay, I'm ready to move on to the next advertisement.
Yeah, that's really interesting, especially with advertising being as of, I don't know, it's a very important industry and topic and has its own future, and it's a whole other conversation that we could do another time. It's prominence in social media and the way Facebook and Twitter, everything work. There's so much of advertisement is driving everything. So I'm glad to hear the research is going in there. I'm really looking forward to, you know, I really do look just forward to understanding more deeply what humans are like and how they work. That's kind of the way I like. So I was thrilled about your research just to get, you know, to take a real look at it and try to get some kind of real answers and analyze stuff, even though it's exploratory research and stuff like that. I'm glad to hear you're going to keep on going with it. So thank you very much for your time today.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's the way we're going. And I think that's the way we need to go, society, whether that's cautionary and that's in the social sphere or in the consumer sphere, or whether it's really pro-social, whether it's helping us to understand that, you know, I can use these type of messaging and this type of communication in something like an anti-bullying campaign or in something that really helps people to stop and hear these messages that are vitally important to our development as a society.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to have to figure out what's wrong with us to fix it and what's right with us to do more of all that. So great. I appreciate your time today. I've enjoyed it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Good talking to you.
You've been listening to the Jabberjaw Podcast Network, jabberjawmedia.com.
Hey there, I am Johnny Christ from Avenged Sevenfold, and I've got a podcast called Drinks with Johnny you're going to want to check out. I sit down with a bunch of different people from all different walks of life, from professional wrestlers to actors, comedians, fighters, musicians, everything in between. I'm just looking to make some friends and have a good time doing it. So if that sounds like something you're into, go check out Drinks with Johnny, streaming everywhere now.
Bonjour, this is Fabulously Delicious, the French food podcast. I'm Andrew Pryor, and every week I bring you the wonderful and fabulous people involved in French food, whether they're here in France like me or from around the world. Enchanté. Each week, we dive into a specific topic, be it a French dish, an ingredient, or a French cuisine cooking technique. My guests are all about French food, so come join me on Fabulously Delicious, the French food podcast. Bon app.